All right, it is 6 o'clock.
Ready?
Yep, it's
Okay.
6 o'clock, so I'll hand it over to you, Martin, and then we'll get it going. I'll do roll call and then we'll proceed with the workshop.
Very good. Okay, we'll go ahead and open up our Planning Commission meeting, April 7th, and we'll start with our roll call.
Okay, Robert?
Present.
Kelly?
Present.
Brian? Lloyd? And Martin.
Here. All
right.
Right. Looks like everybody's present.
And looks like you got some minutes.
So has everybody had a chance to look at the minutes from last week or last month?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move that we approve the minutes from March 3rd, 2026 as presented.
Okay. Everybody in agreement?
Second.
Okay, got a second. Those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? No. Okay. Minutes pass. All right, so we're going to move on to our, do we have any new business? This is basically what we got here is new business. Okay, so we'll go ahead and go with our comprehensive plan workshop. And
open up the public portion.
We will go ahead and open that meeting right now. So we have Ben Floyd on. Who's going to?
Yes, good evening.
There he is. All right.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
I do. I'm not seeing it very good though.
He's there.
I'm going to move over here with you. That's pretty bad. Yeah.
So you're having a hard time seeing the presentation slide?
No, we've got it shared to the big screens in the room, Ben. It's the thumbnails for you that are a little small, and that's okay.
Gotcha. You're better off seeing me in the thumbnail sketch anyway.
And you're welcome.
Thank you. And with me tonight, I also have Spencer Montgomery with JUB and Adam Cares with ACGO. They're going to be, Spencer will be covering the transportation overview, and Adam will be covering the Wildlands Urban Interface and one other topic that I can't remember off the top of my head.
Agritourism.
Agritourism. Thank you, Adam. We gave you just a few light reading materials to look over. That's a joke. Gave you a lot to look over. But tonight we're hoping to walk through the highlights of those documents with you and see what questions or comments you might have. And then we'll talk about next steps at the end of the meeting. We'd like to move forward actually with the public involvement process and coordination with comments on state agencies. But we'll cover that again in more detail towards the end of the meeting. So if we can go to the next slide. So just as a reminder, we are here in the, early mid-spring. We've developed pretty much all of the documents now, except for one, which is agritourism that Adam will share with you is coming your way soon. We've even developed a draft environmental impact statement that's probably 90% ready to go out, 95% ready. This is our potentially last workshop or maybe one more in May. And then we'll get into the adoption process and hearings and all of that. Again, I'll come back to this at the beginning or at the end of the presentation. Next slide. So tonight we're going to talk about two elements. I'll just give a brief overview of the housing element, which you've already seen from last summer. Not a lot has changed from that. Last June when you had our last workshop on that. And then Spencer will share with you the transportation element and some of the latest findings from that work. We'll go through the critical areas code and shrub step mitigation program, the wildland urban interface, the EIS overview, and then, like I said, just a few of the next steps. Next slide. So housing. As we've mentioned to you in the past, there are new requirements, next slide, that we have to address. There's a new GMA goal for planning for and accommodating affordable housing to all economic segments. And we went through a process with the cities and took what the projected growth is at different and the housing needs at different income levels. So from median income down and up, and came up with a plan to provide affordable housing or housing needs to meet all those different income bands. And maybe one thing to note is that most of the, and it's the bottom bullet, but most of the lower household incomes and homeless needs really need to be accommodated in the cities, because that's where the services are. That's where the transit transportation services are provided. That's where you have, you know, the grocery stores and healthcare and other things that all households need. And so the county is just providing for 80% of that median income and above in the unincorporated areas. We also had to show that there was sufficient land capacity to meet the needs of the housing, to meet those housing needs. And the county, of course, has plenty of land capacity to do that. And the county, you know, the county unincorporated areas and UGAs have, you know, historically been going at growing at a pretty good clip up until maybe the last 4 or 5 years. And there's still lots of housing development happening, but more of it is happening in the cities relative to the county. So the county need has, it's still a significant housing need that we're planning for, but it's less than, for instance, we planned for in the last update. We also have to address racially disparate impacts, displacement, and exclusion. So you've probably seen some goals and policies, as well as some provisions related to that in the updated housing element. So let me just pause there and see if there are any questions or comments, anything from what I've given you as an overview, or as you've looked at the housing element, is there anything that you might have a question about from that? All right, hearing none, then let's go to the next slide and Spencer can give you an overview of the transportation element. You're on mute, Spencer.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, although move that mic up a little bit closer, you're a little faint.
There we go, how's that?
Great, thank you.
Cool. I think I just have two slides. This one here just shows some roads, but here's what I'm really going to talk to you about today. And we did present the transportation element last summer, and similar to what Ben said, not a lot has changed. But just to refresh on that a little bit, let me do these in the same order that they're on here. Multimodal emphasis, the part of the Growth Management Act requirements are is that we have some emphasis on all modes of transportation, rail and air. So we've updated the inventory for the Benton County with respect to bike paths and sidewalks and all those kinds of things. There's a significant amount that we have claimed as having been done through the Benton Franklin Council of Governments because of the Benton County coordination efforts through that process. And so there's a lot of work that's been done through there. We recognize that Benton County is primarily rural, identified where there's some places where there are opportunities for those multimodal things to occur. Also, we've given the descriptions for all those things in the inventory. Level of service analysis is a big deal with the Growth Management Act. And so we spent a lot of our effort on that, updating that from the last time around. And just to refresh with you, I do have a map, but it's not included in your handout here. But we had traffic counts on 48 segments in Benton County that your staff identified a couple of years ago. The traffic counts were collected by the Benton Franklin Council of Governments through the whole region. And we evaluated those for existing and year 2036 traffic volumes, volume to capacity ratios, level of service. And all of those, all of them are in good shape today. And in the future, we used a 1% growth rate in the areas where the regional travel demand model does not cover. And we talked with WashDOT about this. And so we did the same thing for state highways. And there were 54 locations where there was traffic volumes on state highways that we could use for a similar evaluation. So you can see on the slide here, there's just one place, well, two places where there's some level of service issues in 2036, Dallas Road up near I-182, and then on State Highway SR-397 down the Findlay area. So some of the things that we've been doing since last summer, we were anticipating the Benton Franklin Council of Governments was updating their what they call a transit development plan. And WashDOT's always updating their plans and programs as well. And so we let them finish those processes. But quite honestly, I took an easier route here and just referred to those documents in yours, and we adopt them by reference. And we've done that in a lot of places throughout the document here, just to in case those things get updated, then they are already adopted through your comprehensive plan. We've identified where there's future improvements that are identified in the state plans. Mentioned a couple of those that are in their project delivery plan. The county road improvement program is adopted by reference. So your staff prepares annually a document, and rather than include it here and then have to go and update it every year, it's just adopted by reference, the whichever one is the most current. But they do a really good job at keeping track of what projects need to be done and what the funding is that's available for road maintenance, for expansion projects, and things like that. So they've got a probably one of the biggest projects, I guess, that the county is doing is Badger Road near I-82, and some extra lanes and safety projects and capacity there as well. So I think that kind of covers at a very high level the transportation element. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Yeah. Mr. Spence, Montgomery, I've got a question. Dallas Road north of the I-82, I understand a lot of that is probably city, but some of that is still county. So is the city and the county going to, as that becomes filled out, are we going to have to look at that area on the north side of the highway there?
Yes, they should. And so luckily, I mean, the good news is that it meets the level of service criteria today and in 2036. The next time we come back, it's not likely to be in good enough condition for a future forecast, if that makes sense to you. So yes, and so Richland has improvements identified that they're working on at the southern end that's within their city limits. And at the north end, I think they've got improvements from Kennedy Road north from there. But there's nothing, no improvements that I'm aware of within the county. And so there's going to be traffic traveling through there. And so it would be a good idea to be coordinating with Richland and have your staff be working on that over the coming years.
Spencer, if I can add on to that, the city of Richland has their UGA boundary adjustment or change proposal where they want to expand the UGA along Dallas Road. And so that also could lead to some improvements in the future as that moves forward, if they decide to annex that.
I'm seeing more and more apartment complexes and large apartment complexes going in out there. So, yeah, so that definitely increases traffic significantly in that area. So that was just a question I had. So anyway.
No, that's very observant.
If you look at Benton County's 6-year transportation improvement plan, Dallas Road between the two cities, city limits, they have a proposed project of widening and adding a pedestrian multimodal pathway along the county's portion. If you go to the Public Works' webpage and look at their six-year transportation plan, so it's being considered at this point in time. I don't think they have funding for it, so it's kind of a wish list item as of now. But I think that they recognize that it is a need in the future. I mean, you've got growth on both ends. So, I mean, it would tell you that it would need to occur in between as well.
Yeah, I kind of see that that's going to be a bottleneck here. If it isn't,
I agree.
You know, it's going to come up here pretty quick.
Yeah.
Yes.
I have a question in regards to the rail systems. Do you have any information as far as when and if the rail system from Kennewick to Hanford is going to be upgraded?
I know that the Port of Benton is working on upgrading, and they've got some funding. I forget just what the source was, but they are trying to improve that track and have funding to do a portion. I forget the lengths of it and exactly where. But they are working to upgrade that so that the train speeds can be increased so that there's less delay when there's a train going through the intersections to, that it would hopefully wouldn't stop traffic.
Automobile. You don't have a timeline on that at all?
I don't have it on the top of my head. I don't have that information right on the top of my head, but I do know that they have funding and that they're working on it.
Thank you.
Any other questions from Spencer?
I'm good.
All right. Well, if you're okay, I'm going to go ahead and say Spencer can sign off since that's his part of the presentation. And thank you, Spencer. Have a great rest of your evening.
Is there a chat? I'm going to look real quick and see if I can find the years for that project. And if I do, I'll put it in the chat for you.
That'd be great. Thank you. There is a chat. All right. Next slide. So one of the things that we've been spending a lot of time on is identifying updates to the county's critical areas code and also formulating a shrub step mitigation program. Next slide. Just a reminder, critical areas covers protections for wetlands, fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas, frequently flooded areas, geologic hazards, and critical aquifer recharge areas. And so some of the things we've done, and you'll see this in the document that we shared with you a few weeks ahead of the meeting, updated the definitions and revised some of the best available science sources. We updated the wetlands rating method and mitigation ratios to comply with the state's latest, Washington State Department of Ecology's latest guidance document. We revised the stream buffers, or what we've changed them to are now riparian management zones, which means that their riparian areas are a separate habitat next to a stream that provides a lot of functions in and of its own right. It's not just for the buffer of the stream, but there's lots of activity that happens within that riparian management zone. And so we revise those buffers to a minimum of 100 feet per the state's guidance. And that's anywhere in the county, regardless of stream type or level of flow. If there's a bed and a bank and a riparian area, that 100-foot buffer applies to that. We've also added in a draft shrub step mitigation program that has mitigation ratios, and we're working to identify both some mitigation properties as well as how the program would work with the county, Benton Conservation District, and a land trust. We're having discussions with the land trust right now. And more meetings to come on that. And so we're hoping we'll bring this all together into the approved program in the adoption process and get the the program set up. What it allows you to do is that developers within any of the cities or in the county or private landowners that have shrub step habitat on their property and they plan to impact that habitat, you know, their plans are maybe they can avoid and preserve some of it on their property, but they may need to remove some of it, that they would be able to buy a credit into a mitigation bank or credits into a mitigation bank and be able to offset those impacts by preserving and enhancing shrub step habitat in other parts of the county. And we're looking in the more of the rural areas in and around the ag fields and areas that the state has identified in their priority habitats and species. And the shrub step restoration and resiliency initiative and a few other initiatives, the mitigation or the best habitat in the county that we could preserve. We also made a lot of other little tweaks and clarifications and update throughout the document, primarily in the 1502, which is the general provisions, 1504 wetlands, and then the fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas. We also made two minor tweaks in the county's flood damage prevention code. Next slide. So this shows you a projection, a very kind of conservative projection. In other words, it over projects the potential land that could be impacted. And you can see it's listed out as different habitat types, different types of shrub step habitat in each of the cities and in the unincorporated county. And core is kind of the highest quality and corridor is the next quality. And then growth opportunity areas are like a restoration area. And then there's other habitat and other PHS habitat. And that's just about 7,000 acres. Again, we don't expect that that's really what's going to get impacted over the next 20 years. We think it'll be something less than that, but that would be kind of the upper limit of that. Any questions on what I've shared so far? Critical areas?
I kind of have a question. Can you hear me? Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So on your shrub steep mitigation, give us an example of how that would work.
Okay. So I can give you a specific example that I worked on. So you're familiar with Southridge and State Patrol area kind of behind Zintel Canyon Dam?
Sure.
So out in that area, which has been kind of a mountain biking area, but there are now some properties that have been purchased and are going through the process of developing that into housing. And so I worked with a habitat biologist and we did a critical areas report for about a 30 acre parcel. And we characterized the habitat. We characterized the species that were out there. We noted where habitat was degraded or where there were like non-native species like cheatgrass and kochia and other noxious weeds and grasses. So that was the habitat report, just characterizing the existing conditions. And we found that to be kind of a mixed habitat, right? Some pockets of actually pretty good habitat and then other areas that were pretty degraded. And so from that, the developer decided that 5 of those 30 acres, and it might have only been like 28 acres, but approximately 30 acres, but basically 5 of those acres would be set aside as preservation on that site on the steeper sloped areas and kind of and kept as open space. And then they would mitigate at a 2-to-1 ratio for the other 25 acres. And so in that situation, this is before the county's program's in place, right? So it's an interim effort that's going on. The developer in that situation has to mitigate for 50 acres. And so they had to write a check to the conservation district for those to get those credits or to get a credit of property that the conservation district will secure and protect in the future. And so the only difference would be with our program is that the developers anywhere they're developing in the county, if they want to use the program that we're providing, they would just purchase credits for their impact. So let's say I'm a developer and I have a 40-acre parcel and I'm going to remove 24 acres of shrub step habitat on that. And it's been determined that that's maybe a lower quality and would get mitigated at a 2-to-1 or a 1.5-to-1 ratio. So I would write a check to the mitigation bank, which would actually, as we're envisioning now, would go to the conservation district. And then they would work with the land trust, and the land trust would provide credits for a piece of property that would be in a conservation easement to offset those impacts. And so that money would be used to permanently protect shrub step in another area of the county. We're also putting in a little bit of a restoration component into every fee. So some of that money would also go to enhancing the shrub step habitat within the mitigation area, the conservation easement as well, so that over time we're actually trying to improve the habitat that's being mitigated for. And then the developer would have that as a condition of their permit and would write their check and move forward with their project. And then the rest of the mitigation and the restoration and all of that would be handled through the land trust, the conservation district, and the landowner that would, you know, that deeded over that conservation easement.
So are those land trust properties, do they try and get them kind of in the same location or, you know, close by, or are they, you know, counties away, or what are we looking at?
That's a great question, Martin. So we're trying to keep it in Benton County, but not necessarily in the same proximity. And you think about all of the, you know, the growth is designed per the Growth Management Act to happen within the cities and the urban growth areas. So you can think about, except for places like maybe Upper Ayman and Zintel Canyon and a few other locations where there are shrub step that's permanently preserved within the cities and urban growth areas, that the rest of that shrub step habitat at some point as the development continues on is going to come out. And so what we're trying to do is preserve then the highest quality habitat outside of the city limits and urban growth areas in the county to remain as shrub step habitat so that we can preserve that habitat and the species that utilize it.
So one last question. So the county has like 520 acres, if I'm not mistaken, along the river. So would that be considered, would the county be able to offer that as a habitat credit for these growth and development and receive any kind of monies to help develop that? Or is this something that has to be set up in advance and that sort of thing?
It's the latter. So the park properties that you're speaking of, and also like Badger Mountain, Candy Mountain, those are already protected as part of our baseline condition, right? But there's still additional shrub step habitat every year that comes out. And so, yes, you could do restoration enhancement to make those areas better. And I suppose you might be able to get a little credit for that, but it's not really what we're envisioning right now. We're looking at other properties, you know, draws and ridge tops and stuff in other parts of the county within ag lands or other open space areas that could be developed that we can protect permanently from development. And then, like I say, preserve that habitat and enhance that habitat to preserve as much shrub step habitat as we can in the county consistent with mitigation. And this is just for the critical areas program and the mitigation offset. My guess is if we have a land trust that becomes more active in Benton County and Franklin and other like Grant County where there's no land trusts that are currently serving, that there might be other lands that are preserved on top of that, that wouldn't be part of this mitigation program.
Okay.
But it could help meet some of the other open space goals of the county and habitat preservation goals.
All right. Thank you.
You bet.
Yes, this is Lloyd. To help me understand this, if a developer had, say, 25 acres and 4.5 acres of it was wetland or pond. Would they be able to develop that and incorporate that area into their landscaping?
Yeah. So for wetlands, you know, the first choice is on-site preservation, right? So we have buffers and updated buffers in the critical areas code that would be applied to that wetland. So you'd have, if it's 5 acres, then you might have a 200-foot buffer around that, or a 250-foot buffer, or 175, depending upon the wetland rating and the water quality and habitat functions associated with it, and then the level of intensity of development around it. But yes, the idea would be to preserve first, and then if there are some impacts that they can't offset, then they would try to mitigate that through maybe participating in another wetland project somewhere else in the county, along with preserving what they are able to on the property.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Next slide. So this just shows you that we're trying to pick the most high quality habitat in the county. And so we had the conservation district develop a quality model, and then we took the state fish and wildlife information and developed a spatial model. And that's what Adam developed, Adam Cares. He put this map together. And so we use it to both identify where the, you know, what type of impacts might be happening, subject to verification of critical areas report, and then also where are the best opportunity areas for preserving additional habitat. And Spencer did put an answer to the question in the chat. So let me just pause and see if he wants to say anything more about that before we let him go.
Oh, just wanted to let you know that I did find something on the timing and whatnot. You guys can read what's in the chat there. It was available on the port's website. You might have to dig around a little bit if you want a little bit more details, but 4 miles and more crossings and be able to increase the speeds up to 25 miles an hour. So good news, over $10 million of improvements.
Great. Thank you, Spencer.
Yep. See you guys.
All right. We'll see you later. Next slide. So this is just more of the spatial priority, the state data. You can see, obviously, the Hanford site has a lot of high priority habitat, but also so do the Horse Heaven Hills and between Rattlesnake Mountain and Prosser, and then out along Wallula Gap and kind of all along the southern boundaries of the county, even going into towards Klickitat County. And then there are pockets of draws and other habitat areas kind of going north to south out amongst the ag lands out there. Next slide. And this just shows you kind of the range of mitigation ratios that could be applied. The left side, and this is something again that Adam Cares put together. Adam, why don't, I know I didn't say you had to, you know, you didn't necessarily have to present this, but you do such a great job. Do you mind giving them an overview of what this slide is sharing?
Not at all. Can you guys hear me okay?
Yep.
All right. So this little visual, we were just trying to present the range of realized mitigation ratios that could come out of the shrub set mitigation program that we are proposing. As Ben mentioned, the ratios are based on both spatial priority. So that looks at that WISRI map that Ben showed, that shows the high value habitats, the cores, the corridors, places where shrub step habitat has larger significance within regional connected networks of wildlife habitat. And then the other component that informs the ratios is the actual quality of the shrub step vegetation. So whether it is, you know, big sagebrush and forbs, or, you know, it's just mostly cheatgrass and, you know, more disturbed sites. And so our ratios factor in both of those things, that spatial priority and the quality to create a range of ratios that can be applied. And for impact to really poor quality and poor spatial or low spatial priority habitat, we can have ratios as low as 0.25 to 1 if they are mitigated with really high quality core habitat. On the other end of the spectrum, if someone is impacting in a habitat core area that has really high quality vegetation, kind of the best shrub step in the county, and they're proposing to mitigate it with some, you know, pretty crummy cheatgrass infested shrub step somewhere else in the county, that would require a much higher ratio, all the way up to 10 to 1. So those are our bounds, 0.25 to 1, all the way to 10 to 1. But the vast majority of the mitigation within this program, we expect to occur at about a 1 to 1 to a 4 to 1 ratio. And the average ratio is right about 1.5 to 1 of what we're expecting. Any questions on that?
Great job, Adam. Thank you. Next slide. Well, Adam, I think you're just going to keep rolling on in.
Back on deck. Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about the wildland-urban interface. Next slide, please. So we're subject, as part of this update, to incorporate new requirements from the state related to the wildland-urban interface. And that new law directs counties to update their code requirements based on new mapping data from DNR that shows areas of high and very high wildfire hazard. And actually, the first part of the law directs DNR to create new maps that show those areas. And then it says within those high and very high hazard areas, counties have to incorporate wildfire protection standards for buildings. Those include siding and roofing materials and turnarounds in long driveways. Driveways of a certain length, there's turnouts required, and then they need to have fire flow turnarounds at the ends of long driveways. And those new DNR maps are informed by wildfire hazard and wildfire risk. Hazard really gets at where wildfire is likely to occur and how severe it may be when it does occur. And then risk says, based on those hazards, where are there going to be potential impacts? Risk is kind of derivative of hazard. Next slide, please. This shows DNR's draft, and very important to remember that it's in draft form. We reached out after one of their listening sessions and asked if they could share this data, and they said yes, with a giant disclaimer that it's in draft form. They're still working on it. They're doing some pretty complex modeling to create this data. But this shows their draft hazard map for Benton County. You can see the bright pink is very high, and the red is high. Next slide, please. So because we don't have the final data set from DNR yet, our team has been working to provide the county with some interim mapping products that they can use to get an idea of where there are areas of high hazard with a little bit more detail, and then also understand where structures may intersect with those hazards on the landscape. So this map shows a different data set that relates to hazard. So this is the relative risk to structures if there were a structure in a location based on wildfire probability and fuels. And this comes from the U.S. Forest Service. The symbology is comparing every pixel to the Washington State average. So the red areas are relative to the rest of the state, very high hazard, and orange and so on. So we've been kind of using this as a proxy for the DNR data. Next slide, please.
Oh, Adam?
Yeah.
This is Martin. Before you move that slide, you have several years ago, I don't remember exactly when it was, I'm thinking 2011, they had a severe fire that impacted houses over there to the, would be the east of 395, and it would be north of what is now 397.
And it was the Boffer Canyon fire.
Yeah, I guess they lost about $10 million worth of houses or more, 20 million maybe. And I see that's not even listed as high. And I'm just wondering why, because what happens is the wind blows out of the southwest. And when you get a spark coming off of I-82 or 397, they cannot fight that fire. They're not going to get in front of that fire and fight it. They're going to fight it from behind, which is too late, especially when it's moving at 30 miles an hour. So I know that the guidelines and everything that you have are for new construction, you know, and so I understand that, but I still think that the risk is high enough to maybe warrant moving that up, bumping that up a little bit there.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and this is a great time for you to make that point. So we're working with these kind of preliminary data products, as you can see, and what we found both here and in other places we use those is they one that I think they're a little bit skewed towards the heavier fuels like timber and sagebrush and those sorts of things, and can under account for the finer fuels like dry grass. And the key thing is that these can facilitate a more detailed, locally informed conversation that typically happens in conjunction with a community wildfire protection plan. And the county has an existing, it's a 2017-18 Community Wildfire Protection Plan. I don't know specifically if it has higher, maps higher hazard in that location. But I'll refer to that document and see if it does. But I think that is typically the appropriate place to describe in more detail those higher hazards. And sort of localized areas of high risk.
Yeah.
And maybe just to clarify, we're not helping update that community wildfire protection plan. We're just identifying some things that we can put in the comprehensive plan to enhance what is already there that deals with this wildland urban interface. But we can certainly share any additional comments beyond kind of what we're assigned to do.
All right.
with the emergency management folks so that they can factor that in going forward when they do their update, next update.
And that, thank you for adding that, Ben. So I mentioned that DNR is rolling out these hazard and risk maps. And the hazard map that I showed you the draft version of, that's coming out first. But the next product that they're working on is where those hazards intersect with assets and with homes. And from what I've heard from DNR, they want that map to be locally informed, and they want this back and forth, exactly what you just shared, for them to be made aware of locations where there might be specific circumstances that elevate the risk to structures, and to incorporate those into those risk maps to show where there are truly where hazards intersect with risks or with assets that could be lost in a fire. So I think there will be space, even though the county is not updating the Community Wildfire Protection Plan, and our scope is really limited for how we incorporate this into the comp plan. There are going to be upcoming opportunities to share information back with DNR to inform those final maps that they're creating.
All right.
So appreciate that.
I got a question about fire breaks. Would DNR allow fire breaks to be chemically treated so that they wouldn't overgrow and have to be re-plowed a couple times a year?
So I can't speak for what DNR would allow necessarily, but we do have some information to share on that specific topic. And it's on just a couple slides from now. So I'll wait. If I could go through like the next map, and then we can talk specifically about fire breaks. It's another good point we want to touch on, and something that we can include added language in the comprehensive plan and reference some other documents that talk in more detail about management practices for fire breaks. So thank you for bringing that up.
Sure.
Let's go to the next slide.
Thank you.
Okay, so this shows, this is another like in lieu of a more detailed product from DNR. This gets closer to the risk to structures that DNR is eventually working on. So this just shows where those hazards are directly intersecting with structures on the landscape. So you can see the area that it was pointed out earlier does kind of show up as a bright spot on this map, that there are structures within that location that might have direct exposure. And it may be that that's informed specifically by that historic fire. I think that's all I have to share on this map. You can see there's kind of a concentrated band throughout the more developed areas of the county that have higher direct exposure of structures. Next slide, please. Okay, so Ben mentioned our scope is relatively limited in how we are incorporating this into the update. Remembering that most of the more specific information, is included in the Community Wildfire Protection Plan. But we provided a memo to the county suggesting that once the DNR hazard and risk maps are available, that they update policies to strengthen the resilience to wildfire on properties that intersect with those hazards. We also suggest additional outreach in the really high hazard areas, particularly in areas where there's hazards and there might be more densely built out communities like the one that was mentioned previously. We also referenced the suggestions shared by fire chiefs in the last comprehensive plan update. There were some really good recommendations about roadside vegetation. You mentioned like, sparks flying from a truck on I-82, igniting grasses. The fire chiefs mentioned that as well. So we've brought those recommendations forward. And then we reference some additional and updated strategies related to fire breaks and vegetation management strategies. And it's really interesting you mentioned spraying in those fire breaks. So there's a couple of USGS publications where they study this issue specifically and talk about the effectiveness of plowing those fire breaks and how that can actually, it can disturb the seedbed and kind of stimulate regeneration of invasive annual grasses and other plant material that can eventually dry out and increase fire hazard. They talk about herbicide, particularly pre-emergent herbicide treatments on those fire breaks on a repeated basis to continually knock back those annual grasses. And over time, they show that those herbicide treatments are effective in reducing fuel loads and how flammable that vegetation is. So it sounds like there's a need for kind of a more comprehensive approach to managing vegetation in those fuel breaks. And the gentleman that shared that question, if you have other comments to provide on that topic, be glad to hear those.
The reason I brought that up is traveling from Kennewick to Prosser, you notice along Interstate 82, all the power poles have an area around the base of them that have been treated so that as fire goes through there, as it often does, the poles don't catch fire.
Gotcha.
And if I can jump in here, I want to give a kudos to Lori Ness, because Lori was the one that provided us the links to these USGS publications. She's one of the members in your audience. If I'm seeing her, it's a small image, but yeah, okay, she's waving. So anyway, she provided us with some of those resources. There are some habitat values that also need to be considered. There are ways you can do even just mowing that also can still provide a break, but allows that native vegetation to come back. And so there's a variety of different strategies that should be considered. Sometimes the most intensive is not always the best approach. And so in our recommendations in the memo, you'll see that we have suggestions for considering both habitat impacts as well and avoiding invasive species propagation as part of the strategies going forward.
You have listed up there for fire chief suggestions, enhanced water supply. Have any of the fire chiefs approached any of the farmers about tapping into their circles? If they had a connection, if they had a connection at the roadside,
yeah,
connected to their circles, yeah. And typically from what I mostly see around here, our fires happen during the irrigating season. There would be a tremendous supply of water at different areas that the fire departments could tap into.
Yeah, so I think go ahead, Adam.
I was going to say I haven't heard that that's occurred.
And like Adam mentioned, we're not really trying to figure out the water supply. Again, we're identifying actions that can be considered in the next Community Wildfire Protection Plan update and in just kind of overall risk management strategies. I think, yeah, the challenge is that there's too far distances to drive to get more water when a firefighting incident is occurring. And so if there were places where, yeah, they had some either high pressure water they could get off of a pump station, or there was a storage facility or something. It was just identified as a, particularly out in the more rural areas, say up on the Horse Heaven, more challenging to get that water supply. And same with communications in some of the more remote areas of the county.
And a good example would be the line that KID put in from the Yakima River along 224. I don't see anywhere that they have placed a connection that the fire department could utilize in that system.
Yeah. Yep. So we've got it highlighted as an action, but like I say, we're not really in the position, or it's in the scope of this effort, the comprehensive plan update, to really get into too much detail. We basically have given some policy update recommendations that can provide the foundation for work that the county staff would participate in when they do the next community wildfire plan update.
Yeah. One thing that, you know, as we flag areas for more coordinated outreach and focused outreach based on location-specific risks that exist, individual communities can also go through a planning process. You might have seen, you know, driving around various areas of the West, you can drive into a neighborhood and there's a sign that says this is a wildfire smart community or things like that. So the FireWise program has a certification process that, you know, all the way down to kind of the neighborhood level, communities can participate in. And while we have the countywide community wildfire protection plan, there can also be smaller scale plans within that. So all of that to say, some of these things, if there's a really localized need, may not have to wait if there was a coordinated effort in the community. Like Ben mentioned, we're not going into that level of detail. Even the community wildfire protection plan may not go into that level of detail, but there's other forms of community level planning that can go on that we will, you know, talk about the potential and provide links to resources that people could use to go into those more detailed.
This is Brian Skills. I'd be interested in learning more about that because I'm the president of an HOA out in Badger Canyon, and we have a approximately 4-acre common area that is not grass. It's not irrigated. It has potential there, but right now it's just open space. And so we had a project here a few years ago where we had wildlands come in and treat it, kill all the invasive that we had in there that the county threatened us about, and then reseeded with native grasses. And so right now we got the spring growth, and then we mow it. But we also have, because my back fence is right along it, one side, it'd be the north side of that common area, we treat it. It's not cheap. Where we sterilize the soil and we put in gravel. And so we keep the weeds. We got about a 10 to 12 foot wide fire break between the grasses and the back fences of the neighbors. And so that kind of project you were talking about or program you're talking about is of interest to me.
We do have the
gravel walking path in there that can be utilized as well. So.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Well, yeah, thanks for sharing that. And I'll chat with Ben about what resources we can share and try to direct you to somebody that could, you know, share more information with you about what's available.
Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I think, are there any further questions on WUI? All right, we can move on. Back to you, Ben.
Thanks, Adam. So the environmental impact statement. I think I mentioned to you that the last environmental impact statement that was prepared that we've been kind of tearing off of for the last several comprehensive plan updates is from the 80s. And so we've developed a new environmental impact statement that looks more specifically at county conditions today and the growth projections as they've, as we have outlined them for you. And so I'm just gonna walk through, I gave you the table of contents so you can see kind of what's covered in the EIS. And so I'll just hit some of the highlights. Next slide, please. So the county determined that it, you know, there's likely to be a significant adverse impact over the next 20 years. And so we're doing this programmatic EIS. We drafted three alternatives. And so next slide. Those include a no action or a no change in kind of the current growth patterns. So it's based upon the existing comprehensive plan and growth trends No changes in land use, no changes in regulations. Alternative two is maybe the opposite of no action. It's like the most aggressive growth, emphasis on affordable housing and more industrial development. We proposed in that alternative that you could see additional multifamily housing, affordable housing in the higher density areas, just in Findlay and Plymouth. And then quite a bit of industrial land that would be designated for future development. And then alternative three is kind of in between those two. So more moderate growth, some additional industrial development, but less than alternative two, and no affordable housing density, higher densities in Findlay and Plymouth, just keeping it as the current code is, which I think is 3 or 4 to 1 unit, 3 to 1 units per 3 dwelling units per acre in those areas. And under the high growth alternative two, it's 8 to 1. Next slide. So this map just shows you what is being changed in alternative three, which is moderate growth. So you can see some land is being changed from GMA ag to rural industrial, or rural commercial, or rural remote. And that was done through the evaluation of the GMA ag lands that were done as part of the last comprehensive update. And we looked at more refined soils for those areas and determined that those lands really were not lands of long-term commercial significance. And so then because of that, then we then identified these other uses for them. We also changed some rural industrial to rural remote or public. There's 367 acres down along Plymouth, right next to Plymouth Island, that is zoned industrial that we're changing to public. So long-term permanent protection and preservation, which incidentally has quite a bit of shrub steppe habitat on it. And then also some rural remote, the properties in Badger Canyon that are part of the DNR land proposal. So that's like 270 acres. And then the BLM property would also be changed from rural remote to open space public. Again, preserving, you know, between those two, over 900 or over 800 acres of 900 acres of public open space that's preserved. So it's about the same area that's moving into protection as is changing from one type of development to another. Next slide. And this just shows you the land, more specifically industrial parcels. Some are coming out and some are going in. You can see the red one along the river that's coming out. And then the red squares to the north are lands that would be changed from developed ag to potentially developed industrial land. Next slide. And that's to meet some of the ongoing demands and plans for the ag development in that part of the area. They're looking at a rail line extension and more packing and controlled atmosphere storage facilities, similar land. And that kind of development can also already occur in GMA ag, but this gives more flexibility if you're able to have a fab shop, you know, right next to the processing facility or something like that, that could also support, truck traffic and those types of things, be able to create a cluster of opportunity there. And that has come from landowners in that area and the vision that they have for that property. When we look at an EIS, we're looking at all sorts of different impacts on the natural environment, earth, water, plants, and animals. We also consider land use, environmental health, which is land and air quality, shoreline impacts, what happens to population, housing, and employment, parks and recreation, transportation, public services, utilities, and then also heritage conservation, which is like cultural and historic resources protection. Next slide. Any questions on the EIS scope or any of those alternatives? So what do we have left to do? Well, not really that much. I'm going to go ahead and let Adam talk a little bit about the agritourism code changes, because that's just fresh on the mind. We had a workshop last week with some members of the public, some stakeholders. So he'll tell you a little bit about that. And then we'll have Damien just give a quick update, or Greg, on some of the minor tweaks they're doing to the development regulations. And then I'll hit the rest of this here, and then we'll be done.
Yeah, so on agritourism, the county asked us to take a closer look at ways to provide additional flexibility for agritourism. And in doing that, our original plan was to piggyback on an effort from the Department of Commerce that in which they were going to create updated guidance for land use regulations related to agritourism and ways counties could provide additional flexibility. And those that guidance document has still not been released. We've kind of been checking in for the better part of a year now, and the document has not been made available yet. So we moved ahead with a more limited scope of addressing specific agritourism issues that that the county has experienced. And one of the early things we did is send out a survey to local wineries, breweries, other folks that are operating agritourism related businesses, generated some early feedback on ways the county could provide additional flexibility, really looking at three main issues. Those issues are increased flexibility around on-site food service, additional flexibility around overnight accommodations, and then whether additional flexibility or additional definitions are needed related to agricultural related entertainment activities. So the things like hay rides and petting zoos and pumpkin patches and farm tours, and there's kind of a long list of things that might be relevant. And so we reached out to our contact list with that preliminary survey. We got some good feedback from that. And then, as Ben mentioned, just last week, we held a workshop with a couple of the respondents to that survey just to get some more specific examples of their experiences and things they actually need. And that conversation really focused on-site food at wineries, specifically wineries, which are kind of the most common agritourism activity that we have seen, and the tastings and sort of on-site visitor experiences that they provide. And we think there's real potential to provide some additional flexibility. Right now, the county's code just allows them to serve commercially prepackaged food, or food that is brought in by a catering service, which really limits what they can do as far as, doing pairings and things that really accentuate the products that they're providing and provide more of an overall experience to their visitors beyond just the wine. And both those businesses express that their industry is struggling. They're really looking for new and creative ways to drive sales and to keep people on their property and provide a quality experience, and that's really where people have shifted, is looking for not just to purchase wine, but to experience the agricultural area and spend time there. And so they need to be able to provide a little bit more on-site food offerings to keep people in their winery. So we developed some recommendations out of that, and we shortly. We'll be sharing those with the county and continuing to work through the exact code language that we want to create to offer some extra flexibility. And the kind of upper limit of that is we can't have restaurants, full-blown restaurants, out in the rural areas of the county. So we're trying to craft really careful language that allows additional types of food options to be served, but not getting into full menu restaurants.
And that's in the GMA ag land, to be more specific.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. And then we did look at overnight accommodations as well, and we really concluded that there's already sufficient flexibility related to overnight accommodations. Folks can have up to 5 overnight units on their property for agritourism accommodations, and those really provide quite a bit of flexibility right now. So that was kind of the focus of that initial workshop. We're going to continue lending detail to that. And that's kind of one of our last major hurdles, as Ben mentioned. Any questions about that?
So the restriction on the ag tourism as far as restaurant is because of the zoning, correct?
Well, it really goes back to the RCW around what can occur on designated agricultural lands. And it's very clear in the RCW, or relatively clear, I guess, that those uses need to be accessory to the primary agricultural activities. And they really need to be confined within areas that are already developed outside of the productive soils, the higher quality soils. And then there's case law, Supreme Court case, King County, and Sammamish Valley. And Damien probably can tell you the exact, I'm blanking on the specific, but it's King County versus Sammamish Valley and basically the wineries in Woodinville. Put some further sideboards in that decision around what is allowable as accessory use within those agricultural zones. So it's really driven by what's allowed in ag zones.
And if I can add on to that, it's also, you know, the commercial development, you know, like a Tagaris winery or whatever, and restaurants, those are more appropriate within the cities, the restaurants, and, you know, where it's a, people may not necessarily be going there for the wine, just to have a nice meal or whatever. And it's obviously it's available, but so it's trying to keep that kind of more urban type development from occurring and taking out ag lands.
It seems to me the rules are made by city dwellers and not people that enjoy the open space, right? I mean, if you've been up to Wildlands, south of Kennewick, right? The Miller property up there. The view up there is awesome. So, you know, the desire to have a more regular capability to have meals and spend some time there versus just go up and have a few beers or whatever.
Yeah.
That's kind of pretty desirable. It's nice. It's pretty cool with the wheat up there and everything, but, and so I see where they're coming from, why they want to have more capability to add this food service.
Yeah. And they can have a food service. It just has to be complementary and kind of featured, you know, integrated with the primary, ag business.
Yeah. And I think what we've crafted so far will provide quite a bit of additional flexibility for folks.
So this is Kelly Hansen. So those RCWs that you're referencing are state driven, correct?
That's correct. Right. Yes.
Yep.
It's funny to see them have an RCW specifying that you can't have restaurants in farmland when everything else the state of Washington does is against agriculture. It seems like it's hypocritical to the top degree.
Very much.
Just going to say it on record.
Fair enough. And we've heard those concerns as well.
You've got farmers that have had the absolute daylights beat out of them and their primary source of livelihood. But they can't have a restaurant to supplement their farming. So, you know, if anywhere were going to be a stand for that, I would think it would be Benton County.
But you can have a restaurant on some river up in the mountains.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Or B&B, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I think part of the problem is the west side is ruined. All the rag land pretty much that they've got close to the city. So, you know, they're trying to make up for it, get credits over here on our side, right?
It's absolutely drive down the state is what we're doing. Yeah. There is feedlots, all of it.
Yeah.
Well, and we are looking to try and provide as much flexibility as we can within kind of the legal constraints, right? We can only recommend what we think would be legal.
Push down below.
But they can have food trucks in there.
Yeah, they do. They can.
I mean, there's probably ways.
They just can't have a full kitchen restaurant.
Yeah.
Well, we definitely are hearing these comments, and like Ben said, we're really we're prioritizing innovative ways we can provide as much flexibility as we think the law provides for.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
And absolutely. This issue is pretty controversial across the state, both sides of the state in agriculture. And I know at the last legislative session, there was a lot of discussion about how to address this. Adam mentioned in the beginning of his comments that we've been waiting on this State Department of Commerce report or guidance, you know, to help give us some insights into, you know, what might be most appropriate. And it's just got, we believe, just gotten mired up in politics. And so, so we're forging ahead as best we can. This could be a topic for the legislature going forward to try and provide some more specific legislative relief. There's a lot of people that are looking at this. So we've come up with some interim suggestions, and then the whole playing field could change potentially in the state legislature going forward. We'll see how it plays out.
Yeah, I think, and this is probably a good segue into the development regulations updates too, Ben.
Yes,
just to reiterate, you guys are echoing what we heard from the folks that participated in the workshop, and part of our updates will include DevRig improvements that hopefully provide some of that flexibility. Along with the comp plan update, we have the opportunity and or obligation to take the development code as it sits and ensure that all the provisions that are in it are compliant with recent changes to state law as well. Department of Commerce puts out a checklist that we use not only for the comp plan update, but also for the development regulations, bills that have passed, other modifications that have gone on, or in some cases could be things like hearings board cases that settled that provide new guidance on what our regs need to reflect and how they stay compliant with the GMA. So we are working through the entirety of our development code to update those things that we need to as part of this effort. We're spending quite a bit of time in the subdivision code to clean up a lot of things that have just kind of been nagging problems in the code for a while. Things that, you know, missing definitions or whatever the case might be. We're just trying to clean up as much of that as we can. The zoning code is much the same way. We're tackling some additional flexibilities with accessory dwelling units based on some legislation that happened this year, and trying to, again, provide the flexibility we can within the limits of the law. The zoning code has a ton of areas where there are just these relics from past code amendments that just didn't get cleaned up. And we're working on taking care of a bunch of that. The biggest chunk of work, I think, is fair to say, is our chapter 1710, which is our permit review procedures. It's how we take any kind of permit type and put it through the public review process to a hearing. That section was in some ways nearly a full rewrite due to Senate Bill 5290 that came out a couple of years ago. We're obligated to implement all of the components of 5290 as part of this update. So it provides a lot of attempts for permit streamlining, tries to address permit timelines so that they're a bit more predictable for all the permit types that we might handle. We're cleaning up a number of things in that section too, just really just housekeeping for the most part. But that has a lot of changes to it. And then the critical areas code, which we've heard a bunch about tonight, that'll all be part of our code update. That pretty well captures most of the code updates from a kind of 30,000 foot elevation. That stuff will all be rolled out to you guys very soon too, so you can start taking a look at that. There's a bunch, so don't be overwhelmed by it, but there's a lot.
I got a quick question.
Yep.
And it's something I've probably read, and I've had the challenges within the HOA with our CCRs and with people violating CCRs. Currently, our CCR says you can't have an ADU. You can't have it's a single family home lots, right? And I saw something where there's going to be some state-driven RCWs that are then going to allow ADUs on properties within developments and stuff.
Yep.
Is there any risk to the state mandating existing HOAs to allow ADUs?
Your HOA can still maintain rules that bar ADUs. Okay. That's your development right. Yep. as an HOA. The flexibility that is coming is that rural ADUs are going to have some more legitimacy now based on the bill that just came out this year, House Bill 1345. And there's additional expansion of ADU capacity inside urban growth areas. But if an HOA chooses to manage its yeah. membership that way, that's a separate matter. Yeah.
So that'll be something that I'm going to have to keep in mind and be in the wiser's ear when they start developing CCRs for the development they're putting adjacent to us.
The new phases.
To yeah. our west, northwest. Because if they were to allow ADUs on those lots, then that's even going to be an increase to the traffic flow that's going through my development where I live.
Yep.
Because there's two ways in there and all the roads we have go stub into where future development's going to be, you know, on the current farm. So there's a big traffic flow issue. And we've talked about that when they were presenting here, right?
Yeah. Understood.
And that future potential access mm-hmm. from the north. Mm-hmm. All right. Got some lobbying to do.
All right, Ben, back to you.
Great. Thank you, Damian.
Yep.
Thank you, Adam. So, of course, we've already talked about the mitigation program, but we'll be finalizing that program and getting that ready for adoption. You'll see clean draft versions of all the work products, tech editing, all of that that will happen here. We have plan to have the SEPA EIS review and a public meeting on May 27th at 6 o'clock right there in your location. And so what we're hoping tonight is that you'll authorize us to move forward with the review, finalizing the documents, getting the review, the EIS notice published and getting that out for public review. And the 60-day state agency review started, so we can start getting more formal comments on these draft work products. And then we would, of course, bring that back to you with recommended updates and share those with you in July and August and get those addressed and get the plan updated. And then hopefully by the end of August, you're ready to go forward with the hearing and make your recommendation. And then the commissioners would get that in September and take their action as well. So that's the general time frame. We recognize you haven't gotten everything, but you've probably gotten 95% of the products, except for the development regulation updates that Damian mentioned that will be coming to you soon. And that'll be a focus that we'll have at our May workshop. But what we'd like to do is go ahead and get everything out and published as drafts so we can keep on the schedule, knowing that you'll have more opportunity to refine and update those documents as we go forward with the comments.
See any reason why not?
Do you want to do that? You make a recommendation that we will release what you've done so far for public review?
Yeah, I can make a motion that we continue with that effort.
Okay.
I'll second it.
All right, so we've gone ahead and made a motion to allow that to happen. And those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. Any opposed? None. Okay. So we'll get that formalized and get that off to you.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right. So I guess any other business?
Yep. I think we've got a couple of folks in the audience from the public. We might want to take some any kind of feedback from them. And then we also have at least one online.
Is anybody from the audience would like to come up and make a public comment?
Okay.
And then just make sure you state your name and your address for me, please.
Debbie Berkowitz, 544 Franklin Street, Richland. So I actually have, and Ben won't be surprised at this, quite a few comments that
I need to speak into the microphone.
Quite a few comments that he'll get to address, but they're more detailed for the most part than is, you know, really relevant to this right now, since this is kind of more of an overview. There'll be comments on definitions and specific habitats that I should be included and stuff like that. But a couple of the more major ones would include that shrub step mitigation. You know, you have this new document, but I know that WDFW is working on new guidelines for mitigation. And I'm hoping that anything that you develop here will also reference or will incorporate the WDFW guidelines by reference. So that, like you do with a whole bunch of other things, if those change, you can just change them by reference as well. So another thing is that it would be important to make the provisions of the chapter apply when whether or not a permit is or other kind of county approval is being sought. So not everything requires a permit. And so not everything goes through SEPA and has those requirements. And yet a lot of these critical areas issues can come up as an activity. And those also need to go through the critical area process and county approval.
So you're going to submit these comments to us, right? So
I am.
We can take a look at them?
Yes, I will.
All right.
But I do have another major comment, and that is that as you do the mitigation, it needs to meet the no net loss requirements for fish and wildlife habitat conservation areas and for wetlands. So I guess one question is, what hearings are required for the mitigation process? what public hearings, how is the public going to be involved or know what's going on? Because that's not necessarily obvious.
May.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, as issues come before you, or maybe not come before you, just go to the administrator, to Greg. How does that get to be more public? Does that make sense?
I'm not sure I understand the avenue that you're talking about. Post-adoption, right?
Post-adoption.
Something comes up.
Something comes up.
We bring it to the department, mm-hmm. for sure.
And how does that get, you know, and then you require mitigation. How does that become a public process or involve the Planning Commission?
It depends on the permit type, mm-hmm. right? So whatever hearing body that permit would go to, the critical areas work would be done before the project went to that hearing body so that the mitigation would be part of a condition of approval.
That's if it's a project. What if it's an activity that
like
doesn't
what?
Necessarily go to a, I don't know, what?
Changing park area.
Okay. Or building a trail or some such thing like that.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
If you want to speak, you need to come up here. Okay.
So, Debbie, are you talking more like enforcement issues? Like after the fact, if someone does something on their property that they didn't necessarily need a permit for, and it's kind of just noticed and then brought to the attention of the county? Is that more what you're getting at?
Partly, but also partly if they bring it to the attention of the county even before they do something that they shouldn't be doing, and realize that there needs to be some mitigation work done. Does that come to a hearing for the Planning Commission? Does it come to the public?
Not necessarily. It depends on how the approval process is going to work. Some things don't have a permit, as you've noted. Compliance with critical areas code still applies mm-hmm. across the county. So if there is something that's going to go on that doesn't have a permit, no, it's not going to come in front of the Planning Commission or the hearing examiner. There may be some administrative approvals that happen through our office with critical areas development code or development permit or something along those lines. But that's
or a letter of exemption or something.
But letter of exemption, right? That is that document's public. There may not be public notice for it, right? Because not everything rises to that level of notice.
Mm-hmm. So it would be public in the sense that it's somewhere where is it public? I guess.
So it'd be a document maintained by our department. If it's an approval or something that we issue authorization to do something, that's a document that's available through our department as a public document.
And it's online?
Not necessarily, no.
So basically one has to figure out, one goes by someplace and goes, wait a minute, what happened here?
And Debbie, for the mitigation property mm-hmm. and for that program, there will be, you know, annual review of the habitat on the property that is in the mitigation bank, and that would be made publicly available.
Right.
You know, because summary of the transactions and all that stuff, all of that it would still be available for the public. I mean, and I think this, what you're talking about is maybe something that would be better to further discuss with maybe Damian and you and I. Because I think it's a little bit different from giving comments on the work products tonight that are right. for the Planning Commission.
Okay, fair enough. And the last thing I had, which is also probably not totally relevant to this, but partly, I wondered if the county might consider starting a conversation about Lights Out during migration, which is a program that could come under a Fish and Wildlife Habitat Conservation Area report or concern that would reduce the bird kill during migration times. So just a thought to bring to the county's attention, because I have the opportunity to do so, and something that Audubon would be very happy to help with. So thank you.
Do we have anyone else who would like to address us? All right, please come forward.
Lori Ness, 2253 Davison Avenue in Richland. So just, I'm going to comment on, you know, what was presented today. And so on the CAO, on the Critical Areas Ordinance, Ben, the 5% left, I think you need to put something in about riparian management zones and site potential tree height, particularly in our drainages that, like the south slope of Badger, they deserve more than 100 feet of a buffer. And that is best available science, according to WDFW. So I think that, I don't know if any of you have, do you know anything about that? But it is a way for in arid environments, because we don't have many trees, to figure out what's going to protect a stream area or a drainage. So I know that you know about it, Ben. So if
you
wouldn't mind putting that in there. We're also, I know the municipalities are waiting for WDFW to come out with their mitigation for shrub step. So I'm kind of wondering why Benton County is going through this plan and that we're talking about, you know, the different types of shrub step. They're considered best available science. If you put out a plan, you're going to need to show that there's certain criteria you have to go through. Peer review, there's like five different criteria that the legislature says is best available science. So you need to be able to defend your policy on shrub step mitigation to actually let it, you know, for it to fly, basically. So, and it's a hard thing because we're running out of places to build, and I get that. So the other thing is it sounds like you want to use shrub step to protect shrub step. In other words, we're not going to develop here, we're going to set it aside. And that maybe I'm misunderstanding, Ben, but it seems like that's what I'm hearing. And that seems to be what everybody wants to do. Well, we won't destroy this shrub step. We're going to develop this shrub step, and then we're going to mitigate by not destroying this shrub step. So I think there needs to be some kind of clarification on that, because that's not allowed. On the Coalition of Farmers and Wildland Firefighters, fantastic idea. These fires are heartbreaking. It just kills me to see that. And you have the power to do that if you're a farmer, firefighter, or if you're not. So I encourage you guys to go for it. You know, form a coalition of some sort. Talk to your neighbors and find out, you know, because when a fire goes, we always go, well, I'm powerless. Well, that's not necessarily the case.
It's not. It's just like the example I presented earlier on the HOA that I'm living in and I'm the president of.
Yeah, you have control.
We had space that needed managed because it wasn't for 10 years of living next to it, weed 6 feet high.
Right.
When
and
I got
the fire marshal gets.
I said, enough. Mm-hmm. We need to start pouring a little bit of money to manage it properly.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm an outdoorsman. I like seeing pheasants and quail. And so it was my idea and my effort with the board to get it approved, to put money into it, to clean it up from the invasive species of weeds
Great.
That we had and the tall growth we had, and then replant with native. And it is
That's
beautiful
great.
When it rains up,
yeah.
and it helps the wildlife. We mow it down when it dries out
yep.
to keep the fire hazard even lower
mm-hmm.
than, you know, when it's...
It's a management
alone,
thing.
If you've got to manage it, we do.
Yeah, I agree. No, I think that's great, and more power to you. We need a lot more people around you know, taking care of their land like that too. So, but yeah, I think it's a great idea. So, and this is kind of an EIS and comp plan comment. I've been really being bugged by the word open space, and I know it's there's an assigned amount of open space each county has to have, and, you know, all the way down to the cities. And all I hear is open space is for recreation for people. And that is not what the legislation, that's not what the Growth and Management Act intended. They say that it needs to be for wildlife as well. We have sensitive species that don't do well with disturbance. And to call something rural remote to me is a bit confusing. That area that's set aside out at Badger, you're going to have cyclists blasting through there all the time. That's not going to do, you know, that's not going to help the jackrabbits. That's not going to help, you know, any other animal that has issues with disturbance. We have to try to find a way to, it's hard to make something attractive where people aren't involved. And that's a big challenge. But we got to do it somehow, I think. If we want, this is a very unique area. Shrub step is amazing. We lose more of it every year from fires. And we just have to make sure that we think about space for other animals or other creatures besides ourselves. And I think that's a good good place to end. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else online or anything? All right, well, that being the case, I'll go ahead and close our meeting, the public part of it anyway. So you guys have any comments about anything? So Ben, Brittany, and you'll go ahead and draft something, and then we went ahead and made a recommendation. Okay. Right. So that will have to be formalized, and then we'll get something to you guys, to Adam and Ben.
Right. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So anything else? All right.
Real quick.
Okay. Well, that being said, we'll go ahead and close this meeting, and thank you everyone for participating.
Thank you. Have a good rest of your evening.
Thanks, right. Everybody. Appreciate all the thoughtful questions and comments.
Yep, for sure.
Thanks for your work.
Let you know we have a new member joining the Planning Commission starting next month.
Okay. What's her last name?
Dana Dollarhide. Appointed today by the Board of County Commissioners to join the Planning Commission, so we'll have one new member starting next. Right.
You can, right? It'll be fine.
Yeah. All right. I think everyone's set.
Good night.
All right. Good night.
Yeah.